Our schedule for today, just so you know, and you'll keep us on track, or we'll keep you on track. So I'm going to try to be really brief. Jeff will speak until about, what did we say, 10:30? Quarter to. And then at quarter to 11, we're going to have a 15-minute bathroom break, a stand-up break, water break. And then you're going to come back here at 11 o'clock for worship sharing. That's where it's not the same as the worship that we've normally had. It's a time for you to sit and to think about, you know, what has happened and to share in a worshipful manner anything that you wish to share at that time. Unfortunately, that's one of the wonderful parts of the weekend, but it's a brief time that we have to do that. And then at around 11:30, Sue Reagan. Sue is one of our past clerks. Sue, will you stand up so they can see you? Just as you don't know Sue, this is Sue Reagan. Some of you are in her forgiveness workshop. Sue will stand and lead us through the closing ritual. All right? And then we'll have lunch, and then we will sadly leave. Okay. Let's see if there's anything else. Planning committee members, remember that we will meet after lunch in the east-west dining room. East-west dining room. That dining room. And thank you. I thought that we had a pretty full explanation and summary by small group leaders, but this is the time when the small group leaders, if you have anything else to add, please come to add it. Jeff will be with us. But if you have nothing to add and you want to get on the road, you may do that. Then the planning committee will meet either briefly or not so briefly after that. Depends on the planning committee. But please, planning committee, intend to be there if you can. Do we have any further report on Lucy Edinger or Pegeen and Frank Durkin-Purry? Anyone has? Yes. For those of you who know either of those people, is this something on this topic? See, I'm sorry. No? Okay. All right. Anything? No, has anyone heard any further word on Lucy?
How about the first word?
I'm sorry?
How about the first word?
What was the first word? Lucy, yes. She fell and said she nicked her hip, but she's fractured. So she's, I think there's been a debate among the family of where she will get, or with Lucy anyway. There's an address if you wish to send her a card, and I know she would love to hear from you. Friends, now that you are all members, you will be receiving further word on everything. We just bombard you with emails. So there will be many of them after the conference, and you will get word on all of these people. All right, last but not least. All right, he doesn't care when we empty the room, so I'm not going to care either. All right, I want to get started, but I do want to tell you one thing. See, I do see you, and I do see George. Do you have to say it now, or can it wait a minute? Okay. Just very briefly, I wanted to say this, that I didn't know Jeff when his name came up as a potential speaker. All you had to say to me at the time, I'm blocking on the name, Esalen. And immediately, you know, the temperature shot through the roof. So I, you know, met Jeff with, intended to meet him, you know, with mixed feelings. And what happened at Pendle Hill was there was a switch in the room. So instead of getting Britton Hall, where we have a beautiful room for the speaker, they put us in Waysmead, which is a wonderful little house. It's about 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom. It's a little bit better than that. But my first conversation with Jeff was to say, oh, and by the way, you're going to be on the 3rd floor sharing with 2 people in the bathroom with 4. Do you have a problem with that? And I, believe it or not, his reaction was, fine. And I just thought, whoa, here's a speaker. This is somebody, I think he could work with our group, you know. I think he could. And so little did you know that, yes. And if you think it was easy for me to say that to him, it was not. Although he was from Esalen, so there was a little secret going. But now two people are very anxious to, but guys, remember, speak soft, slowly. If you don't get that camera out of my face. I think we'll let Jeff handle that, could we? C's worried about the questions, so don't, you know, just, and the questions, try to hold off on the questions, but I'm going to let Jeff handle that. George, do you want to say, you have your mic, so I'll stop. And then after George, we'll pass it over to Jeff.
There was some restiveness about the use of microphones, and I just wanted to make a few remarks. We're recording these sessions, and anything that's not said in the microphone does not get recorded. So understand that great remark that you made will not be lost, will be lost to posterity unless it's said here in the microphone. The other thing on technique, of course, is it makes a difference whether you talk like this or like this. Yeah. And be aware, you can hear yourself and be aware that you're being heard. Allah and Dick Bellin willing, we're going to have the recordings of these available on a private website, and Dick will send instructions to everybody on how to access these files if you need them. I found it very useful in the past to play over parts or all of a speaker's presentation, because I find it takes more than one pass sometimes for me to really pick it up. So anyhow, it is a problem using the microphones, but that's the cost of having it recorded.
Thank you. So I think in 5 or 10 years, I'm going to remember two things about this weekend. One is you all. The other is that damn pillow. That is the biggest joke of a pillow I've ever seen. Somebody needs to issue a protest. Why do they even give you that? It's like, it's ridiculous. Oh, it's fast. Wow. Yeah. So this morning we're going to change pace a little. I'm going to show you, I'll just give you a sense of the morning, and then I'll get into the material. I'm going to just talk for a few minutes, and then I'm going to show you a video clip by a woman named Jill Bolte Taylor, who's a neuroanatomist at Harvard. Some of you may have seen this already. I think most of you won't have seen it, but it really sets the mood nicely for what I'm going to try to do in the rest of the lecture. Yeah, it's a TED lecture. And then after my lecture, where you get the data, get the stuff, I'm going to show you a 12-minute test clip of a documentary that we're working on down in Houston. This is an image of the book cover of the book that just came out called Authors of the Impossible. And a local film company has optioned it for a documentary, so we've been working on that. And I want to show you that film clip because I think it captures well what I'm trying to do this morning. So to pull a couple threads together with conversations over the dinner table, one conversation was with Bonnie again on the archetype of the seed or the archetypes and my questioning of, I think, of the seed and soil complex, which I know isn't an archetype, but is a very ancient symbol. And what I was suggesting yesterday, that we need to get rid of that symbol. And I really believe that. And so the question is, well, what happens when you get rid of an ancient symbol? How does the psyche respond? How does culture respond? I think the answer to that is that the psyche responds just fine. It responds with a new myth, with a new set of symbols and a new story. And my own feeling is that that new story involves the myth theme or the motif of evolution. I've spent the last 3 or 4 years working on a book on the paranormal and popular culture, but also the paranormal and elite culture, which is what this book is about. And this theme of evolution can be traced back all the way back to Darwin and Wallace, who are the co-founders of evolutionary biology. Wallace actually believed in a second line of evolution, spiritual evolution. And that motif has carried through the last 150 years and it is absolutely everywhere in popular culture and also in elite culture. Hence my t-shirt today, the X-Men, which is a popular rendition of that evolutionary mysticism. For those of you who haven't seen the movies, the X-Men are a collection of young people who around puberty realize or discover that they have special powers, special mutations, and they go to this school in Westchester, New York, run by a bald-headed, wheelchaired professor named Professor X, or Professor Xavier, who teaches them that these are gifts, not curses, that they are indeed different, but that they have some role to play in the evolution of the species and of human culture. And I just think that's a wonderful myth. It's a wonderful story, and I use it all the time in class. The kids latch onto it immediately. I think it's our new archetype. And the thing about evolution is that it's, again, absolutely even gender-wise, 23-23. It doesn't imply males possessing females. And evolution is carried on through sex. So it's even and it's erotic. So I think it's a very powerful myth. And it's no accident that the superpowers of these young X-Men and X-Women appear at puberty. That's what the myth says. And it makes perfect sense. It's, again, it's about the erotic. It's about the paranormal that's gifted to us through millions and millions of sex acts and billions of years of biological evolution. So I think that's our new archetype. This morning I'm going to be talking about the paranormal and the psychical, which I'm going to argue have everything to do with the history of mysticism. These things are usually ignored. They're often politely avoided or censored, but I think they're absolutely key. One of the things I didn't talk about yesterday, we ran out of time, was that sexuality is more than just a way that the religious traditions have formed themselves. People often have profound mystical experiences during the sexual experience. Or they have a mystical experience of the divine outside the sexual act, which is imbued with erotic energies. And this is very, very apparent if you read mystical literature. So there's some linkage, there's some deep energetic linkage between profound religious experience and human sexuality. I'm completely convinced of that. So the question is, the way this is usually handled is what the traditions often say is that the sexual is just metaphorical. When Teresa of Avila talks about an angel plunging an arrow into her entrails and she's moaning in pleasure and pain, we're to believe that that's all metaphor. I don't believe that's metaphor. I believe that's a sexual experience that's also a mystical experience, and that you cannot separate spirit and sex, that they're two sides of the same coin. When we move into the paranormal, we find the exact same structure, only now it's not spirit and sex, it's mind and matter. And so what the paranormal is, it's an event, it's an experience that someone has in which the mind is apparently manipulating matter. Now, that's impossible with our Cartesian or scientific worldview. That can't happen, but it happens. It happens all the time. And so, just as I was insisting on the linkage between spirit and sex, now I'm going to insist on the linkage between mind and matter. And I'm going to show you how that works in people's experiences. This actually is absolutely key to Jung. Carl Jung was very close to a physicist by the name of Wolfgang Pauli, who we talked about briefly, I think Friday. Pauli and Jung worked for decades trying to form a system in which mind and matter, or psychology and physics, could be related. And this is what generated Jung's category of synchronicity, and this was also what helped generate Pauli's quantum physics. So this interest in the paranormal or the psychical is not some fluke. It's not some fantasy. It goes back to the very origins of depth psychology, and it goes back to the very origins of quantum mechanics as a theory. As I told you already, I just got back from these 2 weeks at Esalen, and one of the conferences was on the survival of bodily death, and one of the people there was a quantum theorist from Zurich, from what was the Jung Institute, or some type of Jung Institute. His name's Harold Otlon Spacher. And he spoke at length about this. And he spoke about the subjective world, the psyche over here, and the objective world, the world of matter and mathematics and science over here. But for both Pauli and Jung, there was this deeper level of reality that Pauli called quantum wholeness and Jung called the unus mundus, the one world. And so what happens in a paranormal event is that something happening in the subjective world, the psyche, corresponds exactly to what's happening in the physical world. And it isn't that the psyche causes the material event. It's that something goes into the unus mundus and comes out the other side as this event. So again, to take my two foxes, again, I'd never seen a wild fox in my life, and on this trip to the community of George Fox, I saw two, one at the beginning and one at the end. Jung would say, I didn't cause those two foxes to come out of the ditch, but that somehow the intention and the preparation for this trip sinks into the unus mundus and comes out on the other side as these two foxes. So it isn't a causal relationship. And so it can't be studied with classical science. It's a meaningful relationship. It's working like a story or a symbol or a metaphor. So, and I'll come back to that. I'll come back to that again. Another way to put this is that there are different ways of knowing the world, and that reason and science and mathematics are only one way. There's another part of us that knows the world in a completely different way and has nothing to do with cause and probably has nothing to do with time or space. And this is why I think Jean shared her dream with us the other day. How is it that she can have a dream about a woman plopping down a pile of white sheets one night, and then the next day a woman plops down a pile of sheets? That's impossible. That can't happen in our scientific worldview, but it happens. So something in this unus mundus, this fundamental reality that's below or above us, that's neither space nor time. I mean, if you're in a realm that's neither spatial nor temporal, of course you can see things in the future. You're not in space or time. And so that's, I think, what Jung would say about her dream. Okay, so that's what I'm going to talk about. I realize that's confusing. If you're not confused, you weren't listening. Okay? This is extremely confusing because it violates our basic notions of what space and time and cause are. And it suggests that we live in a world that's far stranger, far weirder, and far more connected. Okay? So let's begin. I want to begin with this clip of Jill Bolte Taylor. She'll tell you who she is. And I think you'll see very quickly why I want you to watch this. Part of what I'm going to say is going to relate indirectly to neuroscience. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not going to speak about neuroscience. I have no authority to do that. But I hang out with neuroscientists a lot. I know how they think. And I think what I'm saying here has something to say to that. And I think Jill does too. So let's watch Jill. Oh, we got a planet there now. This is about a 10-minute clip. Let's turn the lights off, please. He disappeared. He's gone. There we go. Off. There we go. I'm going to move.
I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who has been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. And as a sister and later as a scientist, I wanted to understand, why is it that I can take my dreams, I can connect them to my reality, and I can make my dreams come true? What is it about my brother's brain and his schizophrenia that he cannot connect his dreams to a common and shared reality, so they instead become delusion? So I dedicated my career to research into the severe mental illnesses, and I moved from my home state of Indiana to Boston, where I was working in the lab of Dr. Francine Bennis in the Harvard Department of Psychiatry. And in the lab, we were asking the question, what are the biological differences between the brains of individuals who would be diagnosed as normal control as compared with the brains of individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia, schizoaffective, or bipolar disorder? So we were essentially mapping the microcircuitry of the brain, which cells are communicating with which cells, with which chemicals, and then in what quantities of those chemicals. So there was a lot of meaning in my life because I was performing this type of research during the day. But then in the evenings and on the weekends, I traveled as an advocate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. But on the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up to discover that I had a brain disorder of my own. A blood vessel exploded in the left half of my brain. And in the course of 4 hours, I watched my brain completely deteriorate in its ability to process all information. On the morning of the hemorrhage, I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. I essentially became an infant in a woman's body. If you've ever seen a human brain, it's obvious that the two hemispheres are completely separate from one another. And I have brought for you a real human brain. Thank you. So this is a real human brain. This is the front of the brain, the back of the brain with the spinal cord hanging down. And this is how it would be positioned inside of my head. And when you look at the brain, it's obvious that the two cerebral cortices are completely separate from one another. For those of you who understand computers, our right hemisphere functions like a parallel processor, while our left hemisphere functions like a serial processor. The two hemispheres do communicate with one another through the corpus callosum, which is made up of some 300 million axonal fibers. But other than that, the two hemispheres are completely separate. Because they process information differently, each of our hemispheres think about different things, they care about different things, and dare I say, they have very different personalities. Excuse me. Thank you. It's been a joy. Our right human hemisphere is all about this present moment. It's all about right here, right now. Our right hemisphere, it thinks in pictures, and it learns kinesthetically through the movement of our bodies. Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems, and then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what this present moment smells like and tastes like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like. I am an energy being connected to the energy all around me through the consciousness of my right hemisphere. We are energy beings connected to one another through the consciousness of our right hemispheres as one human family. And right here, right now, we are brothers and sisters on this planet, here to make the world a better place. And in this moment, we are perfect, we are whole, and we are beautiful. My left hemisphere, our left hemisphere, is a very different place. Our left hemisphere thinks linearly and methodically. Our left hemisphere is all about the past, and it's all about the future. Our left hemisphere is designed to take that enormous collage of the present moment and start picking out details, details, and more details about those details. It then categorizes and organizes all that information, associates it with everything in the past we've ever learned, and projects into the future all of our possibilities. And our left hemisphere thinks in language. It's that ongoing brain chatter that connects me and my internal world to my external world. It's that little voice that says to me, hey, you got to remember to pick up bananas on your way home. I need them in the morning. It's that calculating intelligence that knows, that reminds me when I have to do my laundry. But perhaps most important, it's that little voice that says to me, I am. I am. And as soon as my left hemisphere says to me, I am, I become separate. I become a single, solid individual, separate from the energy flow around me and separate from you. And this is a portion of my brain that I lost on the morning of my stroke. On the morning of the stroke, I woke up to a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was the kind of pain, caustic pain, that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it just gripped me, and then it released me. And then it just gripped me, and then it released me. And it was very unusual for me to ever experience any kind of pain, so I thought, okay, I'll just start my normal routine. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider, which is a full-body, full-exercise machine. And I'm jamming away on this thing, and I'm realizing that my hands look like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I thought, that's very peculiar. And I looked down at my body, and I thought, whoa, I'm a weird-looking thing. And it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar, and my headache was just getting worse. So I get off the machine, and I'm walking across my living room floor, and I realize that everything inside of my body has slowed way down. And every step is very rigid and very deliberate. There's no fluidity to my pace, and there's this constriction in my area of perception, so I'm just focused on internal systems. And I'm standing in my bathroom getting ready to step into the shower, and I could actually hear the dialogue inside of my body. I heard a little voice saying, okay, you muscles, you got to contract, and you muscles, you relax. And then I lost my balance, and I'm propped up against the wall. And I look down at my arm, and I realize that I can no longer define the boundaries of my body. I can't define where I begin and where I end, because the atoms and the molecules of my arm blended with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And all I could detect was this energy. And I'm asking myself, what is wrong with me? What is going on? And in that moment, my left hemisphere brain chatter went totally silent. Just like someone took a remote control and pushed the mute button. Total silence. And at first I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online, and it says to me, hey, we got a problem. We got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out into the consciousness, and I affectionately refer to this space as La La Land. But it was beautiful there. Imagine what it would be like to be totally disconnected from your brain chatter that connects you to the external world. So here I am in this space, and my job and any stress related to my job, it was gone. And I felt lighter in my body. And imagine all of the relationships in the external world and any stressors related to any of those, they were gone. And I felt this sense of peacefulness. And imagine what it would feel like to lose 37 years of emotional baggage. Oh. I felt euphoria. Euphoria. It was beautiful there. And then again, my left hemisphere comes online and it says, hey, you've got to pay attention. We've got to get help. And I'm thinking, I've got to get help. I've got to focus. So I get out of the shower and I'm mechanically dressed and I'm walking around my apartment and I'm thinking, I've got to get to work. I've got to get to work. Can I drive? Can I drive? And in that moment, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. I'm having a stroke. And then the next thing my brain says to me is, wow. This is so cool. This is so cool. How many brain scientists have the opportunity to study their own brain from the inside out? And then it crosses my mind, but I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a stroke. It's like, okay, I can't stop the stroke from happening, so I'll do this for a week or two, and then I'll get back to my routine. Okay. So I got to call help. I got to call work. I couldn't remember the number at work. So I remembered in my office I had a business card with my number on it. So I go into my business room. I pull out a 3-inch stack of business cards. And I'm looking at the card on top. And even though I could see clearly in my mind's eye what my business card looked like, I couldn't tell if this was my card or not because all I could see were pixels. And the pixels of the words blended with the pixels of the background and the pixels of the symbols, and I just couldn't tell. And then I would wait for what I call a wave of clarity. And in that moment, I would be able to reattach to normal reality. And I could tell, that's not the card, that's not the card, that's not the card. It took me 45 minutes to get 1 inch down inside of that stack of cards. In the meantime, for 45 minutes, the hemorrhage is getting bigger in my left hemisphere. I do not understand numbers. I do not understand a telephone, but it's the only plan I have. So I take the phone pad and I put it right here. I take the business card, I put it right here, and I'm matching the shape of the squiggles on the card to the shape of the squiggles on the phone pad. But then I would drift back out into La La Land and not remember if when I come back if I'd already dialed those numbers. So I had to wield my paralyzed arm like a stump and cover the numbers as I went along and push them so that as I would come back to normal reality, I'd be able to tell, yes, I've already dialed that number. Eventually, the whole number gets dialed, and I'm listening to the phone, and my colleague picks up the phone, and he says to me, and I think to myself, oh my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever. And so I say to him, clear in my mind, I say to him, this is Jill, I need help. And what comes out of my voice is, roo, roo, roo. And I think, oh my gosh, I sound like a golden retriever. So I didn't know that I couldn't speak or understand language until I tried. So he recognizes that I need help, and he gets me help. And a little while later, I'm riding in an ambulance from one hospital across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And I curl up into a little fetal ball. And just like a balloon with the last bit of air just right out of the balloon, I just felt my energy lift and just I felt my spirit surrender. And in that moment, I knew that I was no longer the choreographer of my life, and either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was perhaps my moment of transition. When I woke later that afternoon, I was shocked to discover that I was still alive. When I felt my spirit surrender, I said goodbye to my life, and my mind was now suspended between two very opposite planes of reality. Stimulation coming in through my sensory systems felt like pure pain. Light burned my brain like wildfire, and sounds were so loud and chaotic that I could not pick a voice out from the background noise, and I just wanted to escape. Because I could not identify the position of my body in space, I felt enormous and expansive, like a genie just liberated from her bottle. And my spirit soared free like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria. nirvana. I found nirvana. And I remember thinking, there's no way I would ever be able to squeeze the enormousness of myself back inside this tiny little body. But then I realized, but I'm still alive. I'm still alive, and I have found nirvana. And if I have found nirvana and I'm still alive, then everyone who is alive can find nirvana. And I pictured a world filled with beautiful, peaceful, compassionate, loving people who knew that they could come to this space at any time and that they could purposely choose to step to the right of their left hemispheres and find this peace. And then I realized what a tremendous gift this experience could be. What a stroke of insight this could be to how we live our lives. And it motivated me to recover. 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, the surgeons went in and they removed a blood clot the size of a golf ball that was pushing on my language centers. Here I am with my mama, who's a true angel in my life. It took me 8 years to completely recover. So, who are we? We are the life force power of the universe with manual dexterity and two cognitive minds. And we have the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in the world. Right here, right now, I can step into the consciousness of my right hemisphere where we are. I am the life force power of the universe. I am the life force power of the 50 trillion beautiful molecular geniuses that make up my form, at one with all that is. Or I can choose to step into the consciousness of my left hemisphere, where I become a single individual, a solid, separate from the flow, separate from you. I am Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, intellectual, neuroanatomist. These are the we inside of me. Which would you choose? Which do you choose? And when? I believe that the more time we spend choosing to run the deep inner peace circuitry of our right hemispheres, the more peace we will project into the world, and the more peaceful our planet will be. And I thought that was an idea worth spreading. Thank you.
Okay, so there's Jill. That's really quite foolish to show that to you before I speak. But I wanted you to see that because a lot of what I'm going to say is going to be a challenge to this sort of materialist world we live in which mind and consciousness is defined entirely by the left brain. That's really the world we live in. It's the world I live in the university. All the methods of the university are left brain methods. There are no right brain methods in the university. We live in language. We write books. We speak endlessly. We analyze things. We assume that time is linear. We assume that human beings are these little egos that battle one another. That's the world we live in. But of course, that's just half of us, right? If Taylor's right, and I'm assuming she's right. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah.
No. And, you know, watching this with you here this weekend, it made me realize, well, oh my God, this is the neuroscience of Quakerism. you know, this is Quakerism. You move into the right hemisphere and you live in the light, and she calls it energy, but you can just as well call it light. And, you know, the ethic she sets out there that she realized in that energy is essentially the Quaker ethic. Now, she invokes Buddhism, if you noticed, to articulate it, but it could have just as easily been articulated in another language. So, if you read Taylor's book, what you realize is that she leaves the door open about how to interpret this. Some of the times she speaks, you think, oh, she's talking about the right hemisphere, that the right brain is producing this state of mind. But if you read the book, you realize that she's really not saying that. What she's saying is that consciousness, or this energy, is transmitted through the brain. It isn't in the brain. When it's transmitted through the left hemisphere, it comes out as language and reason and mathematics and science and culture and religion and scripture, more words, 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 words. When it's transmitted through the right brain, it comes out as the light, this cosmic energy, being at one with the universe. You know, that basically the stuff of mysticism. And so, you know, I think that's kind of the message today, is that there are two sides of us. The human is two, as I like to say. The human is two, not one. And reason is only on one side of that. And I think this fits in, of course, perfectly with depth psychology. I think this is what Jung was saying. To be wise, you have to speak in symbols. Symbols, of course, are the pictures of the right brain, not the words of the left brain. Okay, so that's Jobolti Taylor. So how did we get here? Again, I don't want to speak about neuroscience because that's not my area. I want to speak about the dream of the sheets or the two foxes, what we call psychical or paranormal experiences. And I want to give you a little history of this. And then I want to show you the video clip we're doing, and then we can have a conversation. When I was preparing for this weekend, I came across a little book called The Book of Miracles. Has anybody seen this? George Fox, it turns out, was known for his charisma and his healing powers, and for his, what we might today call his psychical powers. Those miracles were very much part of the early manuscripts of his journal, but they were all taken out. They were taken out by the early editors because they were too controversial. They felt that it would draw away from the movement. So they've just been reissued. A man named Henry Cadbury in 1932 rediscovered this Book of Miracles. It's just a series of sentences, and all you have is the first clause and the last clause. Everything else is gone. It's essentially a lost book. It's a lost book of Quakerism. And in the introduction to it, Rufus Jones looks at these miracles, and he suggests that these miracle stories, which are essentially all cures, that the cure stories are essentially true. In other words, that they happen. They're probably exaggerated, as most religious folklore does, and that they witness to the mind's extraordinary ability to transform the body. In other words, the mind's ability to heal the body. And then Jones at the end says, whether they should be classed as miracles is another matter. So he sort of resists this traditional language of miracles, but suggests that these things happen anyway. And it's this move that really generated the study of these things in the 19th century. It began actually at Cambridge, in an elite British university. And it started with a classicist named Frederick Myers. So he was an expert on Greek and Latin. And Myers and his philosophy professor and a number of top scientists of the time, including Wallace, the co-founder of evolution, formed a society called the Society for Psychical Research. And it was based in London. And what they did, what their concern was, is that after Darwin, after geology and Darwin, faith was in a serious crisis. It was really religion against science in a big time way. And what these intellectuals were trying to do is say, we don't want to surrender our science, but we think there's something in faith, and so we're going to form a third way. They called it the tertium quid. They were classicists, so they liked to use Latin phrases. Tertium quid means the third thing. It means that realm of knowing that is both scientific and religious. Or if we'd, I think we'd say today, spiritual. And so they were looking at these sorts of things. And what they did is, they did something really interesting. They put ads in the newspapers of London, and they asked for unusual experiences around the death of a loved one, 12 hours either side of the death. So you could have this experience 12 hours before your loved one dies, or 12 hours after, or any time in between. And they got thousands and thousands of letters. Thousands. And they went out and they checked these stories. They interviewed these people. They checked coroner reports. They basically behaved like good anthropologists of their own culture. And the first book to come out was a book called Phantasms of the Living, which looked at 701 of these cases. They found that about 95% of them could be thrown out. Weren't convincing, or there was something about them that was not usable. But the other 5% was mind-blowing, and that's what they put in this book. And they called these crisis apparitions. And what a crisis apparition is, it's when a loved one is either in danger of dying or is actually dying, and another loved one suddenly knows this, or has a dream, or sees the person in a waking vision. And it doesn't matter how far they are apart. Space is completely irrelevant here. And oddly enough, so is time. So often a parent will see the death of a son or daughter before it happens. So they collected 701 of these, put them in this book, and one of their conclusions is that the human being is two, that there's this, they called it the superliminal self. And they meant essentially the ego, what we're in now. So there's this above, the limen is Latin for boundary. Mary, you were doing liminal. I mean, that's where the word comes from. It means boundary. Yeah, threshold. So above the threshold of the psyche is what we're in now, or at least what I'm in now. Yeah. But below that threshold, what these researchers called the subliminal, sub means under, liminal, under the threshold, is this sort of cosmic mind that is not limited to space or time. And that communications can happen in that subliminal realm. But when they come up into the superliminal, the ego, they pop up usually in metaphorical or symbolic form, often in dream form. Because the subliminal can't communicate with the ego directly. It can only communicate in symbols. Okay? And as they collected these and collected these and collected these, this Frederick Myers came up with a word. He came up with a new word to describe what was happening. He called it telepathy. He coined the word in 1882. To describe these crisis apparitions. And he meant something very, very precise that I suspect you're not aware of. First of all, the telegraph had just been invented. Tele means from a distance. Graph or gram means writing, so writing from a distance. Telepathy is Greek for profound, deep feeling, pathos, from a distance. So Myers' notion was that this wasn't a telegram where you're typing out words and sending it through the subliminal space. This was a feeling. This was a passion. This was an emotion. That's what triggers psychical events for Myers and the society. It isn't that you just decide to pick up the phone and call someone. Something really dramatic has to be happening, and you have to be connected to that person. And if you are linked to that person emotionally, you will likely know when something is happening to them. So that's why they called it telepathy. It had everything to do with emotion and connection. In fact, Myers even argued that it had everything to do with eros, and he used the Greek word. Remember, he was a classicist. He had read his Plato. And for him, eros meant this mystical, erotic force that connects human beings and leads to philosophy and art and culture. The paranormal was coined later than that. The way these folks worked is that they went to mediums and seances. They didn't just collect stories. They actually went out into the field and attended seances. And during a lot of these seances, very, very weird stuff would happen. Some of it no doubt fraudulent. Much of it entertainment, theater. But some of it real. Again, the trick was always mixed in with the truth. And one of the things they witnessed over and over again was objects that seemed to be moving without anybody touching them. Or tables lifting. Or the really strange stuff was what they called apports. A-P-P-O-R-T. Apport. An apport is essentially an object that appears out of nowhere. It's teleported in, as they would say later on. And these were the sorts of things. Also, poltergeists. Poltergeists were also heavily studied. A poltergeist is German for angry ghost. Poltergeist. And what they found with poltergeists is that they inevitably... Remember Pauli? Pauli was essentially manifesting poltergeist phenomenon. But he was unusual because he was a mature man. Most poltergeist activity occurs with adolescents around puberty. And these adolescents are highly, highly conflicted emotionally and sexually. And so the theory was is that this emotional and sexual conflict builds, and then it exteriorizes itself and it starts blowing up things, literally sometimes. Windows break, objects move, furniture pops, curtains catch on fire. This sort of thing. This happened over and over. I mean, this is well studied. This is not just anecdotal. And so this is what they called paranormal. And by paranormal, they didn't mean what we see on TV today. They meant to refer that they believed it was normal. But we just didn't know what the laws are. In other words, they rejected the notion of the supernatural. They hated the category of the supernatural. They thought that this stuff was some aspect of the real world that can be studied with science, but that it escaped our present models of what the natural world is. And that's why they called it paranormal. Para means beyond, normal, of course, means normal. But it's still part of the world. And so this is what they were trying to study. On this side of the coast, I should say they were not alone. William James at Harvard University was the main figure in psychical research on this side of the coast. He's often studied for his varieties of religious experience. But again, what people don't realize is that much of his life was spent studying exactly this, psychical phenomena. And he was pretty adamant that it was real, but that, again, we didn't have the right way looking at it. There were also other popular literary and cultural figures that were completely obsessed with this stuff, including Mark Twain. Samuel Clemens had a series of these events in his life. The most dramatic was when his brother died. His brother's name was Henry. Sam and Henry were working on a riverboat called the Pennsylvania. Sam got in a fight with one of the captains and left the riverboat. His brother Henry stayed on. And one night, Samuel had a dream of seeing his brother's corpse in a metal casket, dressed in his older brother's suit, with a large bundle of white roses on his chest, and a single red rose in the center. So it was a very precise dream. It really, really upset him, this dream. So he got up, he took a walk, he wasn't even sure he was dreaming. And a few days later, the boiler blew up on the Pennsylvania, and his brother Henry was killed. And he went, of course, to the funeral. This is what happened when he entered the funeral home. When Sam entered the dead room of the Memphis Exchange on June 21st, 1858, he was horrified to see the enactment of his dream, his dead brother laid out in a metal casket in a borrowed suit. Only one element was missing, the floral bouquet. As Sam watched and mourned, a lady came in with a bouquet of white roses with a single red one at the center and laid it on Henry's chest. So there, you know, there you have it again. Clemens became, again, obsessed with these things. He collected them his whole life. In 1878, he even gathered many of these together and published them in Harper's Magazine, which was, you know, the main magazine of the time, in an essay called Mental Telegraphy. Clemens was especially interested in what he called crossed letters. Again, this is before email, right? A crossed letter was when you hadn't heard from a person for years or maybe decades, and so you send a letter out through the mail, and immediately after sending the letter, you get a letter from that person. So the idea is somehow that you could read it two ways, that your intention of sending out the letter somehow triggers that person to send a letter in the past, right? Because the letter's crossed in the mail. Or you could argue that actually your writing the letter is a precognitive sort of sense that you have, that this person has already written you, and so you write your letter and send it off and the letter's crossed in the mail. Twain believed in this so much that there's this wonderful scene where this father writes him, and he says, you know, I haven't heard from my son for years, and I'm really worried about him. And Samuel Clemens writes back, send him a cable. He says, send it to Peking if you like. In other words, if you don't know where your son is, how do you send him a cable? He said, it doesn't matter. Just send him a cable. Except that, you know, he was perfectly serious about this. So the father took his advice, sent a cable, and a few days later received a letter from his son. So, again, this weird notion of communication that, and notice that it follows the technology. It's called mental telegraphy. When Upton Sinclair later writes about the same thing in the 1930s, he calls it mental radio. You know, now I'm sure the next metaphor is some computer metaphor. So it always follows, the way the brain works, always follow, the metaphors always follow the technology of the time. And this, by the way, is why I object to thinking about the brain as a computer, which is exactly how modern psychology thinks about the brain. The reason I object to that is it represents a profound historical ignorance. Because if every culture or every time period talks about the brain according to its own technology, and those technologies change, what makes us think that the computer metaphors are any better than the radio metaphors or the telegraphy metaphors? Yeah. Right. The reason the computer metaphor is so powerful is that the brain in some ways does work like a computer in ones and zeros. The neurons either fire or they don't fire. So there is a lot of truth there, but I think historically it's very problematic. Okay, want to talk about one more thing before I show you the video clip. So where does this take us? And again, this goes back to this group I've been meeting with at Esalen for a number of years called the Survival Seminar. They published a book a few years ago called Irreducible Mind. They started out asking the question, do we survive bodily death? Is there something about us that survives the destruction of our physical forms? And they decided not to tackle that directly, because obviously that's been asked for thousands of years and never been answered. So they said, well, what about if we tackle a smaller question about whether mind and brain are the same thing? Because again, if brain produces mind and the brain dies, then mind goes away. But if mind is not produced by the brain, then when the brain dies, it does not go away. And you can hear somebody like Jill Bolte Taylor suggesting exactly that. If you read the book, she suggests very strongly that consciousness is transmitted through the body and the brain. She calls it a portal. She calls the brain a portal. This is what we call the filter thesis. The filter thesis goes back to Myers and James, and then goes through people like the French philosopher Henri Bergson, Aldous Huxley, whom we've already met, Albert Hoffman, whom we've already met, and comes into the modern period. And again, what the filter thesis says is that virtually everything about our egos and our language and our histories is indeed in the brain. It's in that left side that Jill's talking about. And so when that deteriorates, the ego dissolves, those memories go away, language goes away. That's all true. But that's not what consciousness is. Consciousness is not the ego. Consciousness is not cognition. Consciousness is consciousness, and it's filtered through the brain, not produced by it. The reason this is so helpful is it helps us explain a dream again, like Jean's dream of the sheets or Samuel Clemens' dream of his brother dying, because consciousness is somehow going into a realm that's neither spatial nor temporal. It's getting information from the future or from another place where you're not, and it's bringing it back to the brain. So that's impossible if we're entirely in the brain. If I'm entirely in the brain, there's no way I can see the future. There's no way I can know when my grandmother's dying. That can't happen. But again, it happens. And so the filter thesis says, well, we need to embrace all of modern science, what it tells us about the brain, but we also need to acknowledge that there are experiences that we have that can't be explained by that model. And so we need to think of consciousness as greater than that, as something else. Okay? So that's the basic idea. I want to show you this film clip now, and then we can have a conversation about all this. There's just a few things I want you to know about the film. It's called Authors of the Impossible, and it's based on four authors. Frederick Myers is one. A man named Charles Fort is the second. Fort died in 1932. Jacques Vallée, a contemporary ufologist, and a French philosopher named Bertrand Meust. You don't need to know those people, but in the opening credits, you're going to see those four people's books flash on the screen. And so I want you to know where the film's going. What you're going to see is four clips of four different individuals. And much of this is going to be in what are called storyboards. So a storyboard is essentially a board that an artist draws to represent a scene. And you're going to see some of those marked animated, and that means it's going to be fully animated by the studio's animator, or it's going to say live action, and that means I'm going to be there talking to the camera. We don't have enough money to do all of this yet. That's why you use storyboards. You're also going to see a box floating next to me. This is the central image of the film. It's called a pinhole camera. It's a primitive camera. And you're going to be inside that pinhole camera at the very beginning of the clip. And that's actually fairly polished. So you'll see polished parts and you'll see rough spots. Finally, there is one historical error in this clip. This is just a rough clip. We'll fix it. But I'll just offer that to you. If anybody can locate the historical error, maybe you can get a bonus prize. I actually don't have a bonus prize, but we'll clap or something for you.
There's a green ribbon.
Oh, do we still have the green ribbon?
Absolutely.
Dixon? Well, you can. You need that for next year, though.
No, it lives in this conference.
Oh, okay. You can wear the green ribbon.
Next year, it's meant to be with
you. Good. Okay, so let's watch this clip and then have a conversation. Where are we for time, Ellen? Good. We're perfect then. This is perfect. And I'm going to need the lights off, please.
Yeah, that's because I'm trying to say something. You don't want to talk to us instead of this.
No.
No, this will generate lots of discussion.
I know.
I'm sure. I'm really sure. Oh, well, we can talk about four. The other reason I want to show you this is it makes me look really cool. No, yeah, but I do. Okay, now, here we go. That could be you.
An opening is a beginning, but it is also a whole. I want to open with four stories that could not have possibly happened, which happened. I have chosen these stories carefully. I know three of the four visionaries. As much as anyone can be, I am confident that these events happened to these individuals. What they and countless other stories like them mean is quite another matter. Doug Mensch is a prolific and well-known comic book writer. Name a superhero comic, he's probably written it, including Planet of the Apes. That was what he was writing anyway, back in the 1970s at his home in the wooded hills of eastern Pennsylvania.
I kept the basic structure of the gorillas being the super bad guys. You know, they were the heavies. And my leader of the bad guy gorillas was Brutus, aptly named, I thought.
And so Doug writes a scene about a black hooded bad guy named Brutus. Brutus invades the human hero's home, grabs the hero's mate by the neck, and puts a gun to her head in order to force his will on the human male.
Just as I finish that scene, I heard my wife way on the other end of the house say my name in a slightly odd way. Nothing very alarming, but enough that I felt like I should get up right away and go see what she wanted. And so I walked through the long house and stepped down into the living room and was confronted by the horrific sight of a guy wearing a black hood with his arm around my wife's throat and holding a gun to her head. It was exactly what I had written, except with a gorilla wearing a black hood This was a man, of course, but it was so so immediate in relation to the writing and such an exact duplicate of what I had written that it became an instant altered state. The air in the room congealed, became almost like fog, and yet paradoxically I could see with greater clarity, I could see the individual threads of his black hood. And it really does make you wonder, are you seeing the future? Are you creating a reality? Should you give up writing forever after something like that happens? I don't know.
As a graduate student, analytic philosopher Stephen Browdy was, by his own description, an arrogant, hard-nosed materialist. That would change.
Now, I won't mince words. What happened that afternoon scared the hell out of me. For 3 hours, I observed my own coffee table tilt up and down without visible assistance as it tapped out messages to us from three alleged beings, John Wayne, the River Styx, and a man named Horace Jeckham.
Steve then did the rational thing. He completed his PhD in philosophy and got tenure.
I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid.
Since then, Stephen Browdy has written 5 especially provocative books, all of which orbit around the questions posed by that floating, tapping table, and his intuitive suspicion that it was not a dead cowboy, a mythical river, and a man named Horace who accomplished the impossible. It was the three of them who controlled the table with still unknown, unconscious, unacknowledged powers that can find no place in our present worldview. After her daughter's rare harp was stolen in the Bay Area in 1991, prominent American psychoanalyst Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer exhausted all the normal police channels. In desperation, she took a friend's advice and contacted a psychic healer and map dowser in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Using a map of the Bay Area, Harold McCoy told Mayer over the phone the precise location of the house where the stolen harp was located. In Oakland, it turned out.
Harp?
After recovering the harp, Mayer found herself now missing something else, her sense of objective reality. This, she thought, changes everything. Indeed, it did. Elizabeth would spend the next decade of her life intensely researching and writing about the history of psychical research, of parapsychology and physics, really anything having to do with the true nature of mind and what she would come to call extraordinary knowing. Adam is a friend, a colleague, a former Benedictine monk, an accomplished academic author, and a practicing psychotherapist. In 1968, he was living in Toronto, Canada. A little after 3 a.m. on June 6th, he suddenly awoke, instantly and completely.
I turned on the light, and not knowing what else to do, reached for the transistor radio beside my bed.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
I was hearing a California station, one of those strange late-night AM bounces.
The senator's now turning around with his wife, Ethel. They're going to leave the platform. The hundreds of supporters who've been standing in here for 3 and 4 hours, now leaving with smiles on their faces, many of them still giving the V for victory sign.
I was stunned. I could hardly believe what I was hearing.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today
June 6, 1968.
I was devastated. I was an admirer of Kennedy and his campaign. I'd seen him at the exhibition grounds in Toronto the fall before. And I'd even shaken his hand as he left the area. Later, when I reflected on what happened to me in those few minutes that night, I began to realize that something truly extraordinary had occurred. I've never before, and have never since, gone instantaneously from a sound sleep to total wakefulness. The fact that when I reached for the radio, it was tuned to a position on the dial that would give me that particular California station. And the fact that the events of the assassination occurred within 5 minutes of my sudden awakening. This had seemed to indicate that whatever the explanation, some kind of precognition was involved, that is, the knowledge of something that had not yet occurred.
The stories of Doug, Elizabeth, and Stephen are essentially unanswerable. If we accept them as true, we cannot help but to sympathize with Elizabeth. This changes everything. But let us admit up front and immediately that most of our experiences of such things, maybe yours, are more ambiguous, more open-ended. Take Adam's story. It is tricky, isn't it? It can, after all, be read in two very different ways. Inside the box, that is, from within Adam's own experience, there was something clearly and unmistakably uncanny about it. Outside the box of those personal experiences, however, an observer could just as easily read the story as a series of striking coincidences and nothing more. One is left then with a profound hesitation, a fundamental uncertainty or question mark. But what if this sense of coincidence is precisely what is inside the box, and it is Adam's uncanny sense of things that is operating outside the box, as we say? What if there are patterns and plots in our lives that simply cannot be read and understood from a normal, sense-based perspective? And what if paranormal experiences, like those of Doug, Elizabeth, Stephen, and Adam, are a kind of signal from or refraction of this other dimension of time and space into the brain and its box? I begin with such questions not to pretend some knowledge that I do not possess, like the professional debunkers or the true believers, but to provoke and perform our almost total ignorance of such things, and more positively, to call us out of our rationalist denials and naive assumptions into something more. I am not after easy rational solutions, much less beliefs in this or that cultural mythology. I am after liberating confusions. I am after the impossible.
Okay, good. So questions, conversation. I think we have, Ellen, what do we have, about 15 minutes? So we got, yeah. Hold on, we have to be good.
We 20 minutes.
Okay, good. That's good.
Are you familiar with the research of Rupert Sheldrake?
Yes, I am. The question was, am I familiar with the research of Rupert Sheldrake? And the answer was, yes, I am. That doesn't help much, does it? Do you want to talk about Rupert? You probably know more than I do.
Well, I've heard him speak, and I know that he's done this research about animals knowing when
right.
their owner is coming home.
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen this, but I've been told about this. He's a biologist by training. And he believes in fields, biological fields, that we morphogenetic fields that are set up in, with when living organisms interact. And he did this study where they had two cameras. So one camera team followed the owner of the dog, you know, all day, going to work or wherever. And another camera was focused on the dog at home. And it shows, apparently very convincingly, that the moment that the owner decides to go home, regardless of when in the day, the dog immediately gets excited and runs to the door. You know, so there's this sort of connection set up between the dog and the owner. Yeah. Janelle.
I'm wondering if you're familiar with, there's the quantum physics research that's been looking at how it's actually quite conclusively proved that events in the future can affect events in the past.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a couple comments you made here and before about how this is sort of beyond science, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that science is starting to sort of catch up what we've maybe long known.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. When, you know, these quantum physicists who are at these meetings, this is exactly what they're talking about. And the way they put that is that these events violate classical physics, but they don't violate quantum physics. And so they think that quantum physics is the way to at least get the scientific world to begin listening to these things. But they differ. Quantum physicists differ on why and how. But I think you're absolutely right, and that's really where a lot of the conversation is now. And not that the weird thing about quantum physics that they talk about as much is that the observer actually determines how reality behaves. So if they set the experiment up one way, it behaves like, say, a particle, and if they set it up another, it behaves like a wave. And in quantum theory, the observer actually affects what's called the collapse of the wave function, which is, the way I understand it, in quantum theory, reality is always in potential. It's a statistical wave or a smear of possibilities, and it doesn't collapse until it's observed. So it's this weird, you get into these weird loops about whether we're creating reality by observing it.
The most recent experiments they've been doing that I've read, they were in the Discover magazine this last March of 2010, where they talked about, they've set up a certain series of experiments that, without going into the boring quantum mechanical details, essentially prove that you can have an event that literally takes place in the past or in the future that affects something in the past. So observations that they make at 3 o'clock will affect an observation that they see at 1 o'clock.
Right.
And it's quite complex, sort of the physics behind how that happens, but it's been proved in several different experiments.
I giggle when I talk about these things because I have no idea what I'm talking about. But when I listen to them, the other thing they talk about a lot is entanglement. There's a man named Dean Radin who writes a lot about entanglement. And essentially what entanglement means is when two particles interact in one space, no matter how far apart they are in the universe, when something happens to this one knows immediately. And it has nothing to do with the speed of light. It's part of this quantum wholeness again. Yeah.
I have a quick question, but first I wanted to say, of course, Jean's dream yesterday was an example of this, but I think there are probably many people at this conference that have had precognitive dreams and have had real experience of what you're saying.
Yeah.
And also, the examples of scientists being familiar with this world. You know, Jung, of course, always said he was a scientist, and what he was talking about was experiences. One of our Quaker mystics, Howard Brenton, was originally a physics teacher, probably before quantum physics. So I just wanted to say that this isn't such a strange world to us. But I wanted to just ask, what was Taylor's book, Jill Taylor's book? I didn't get that title.
It's called My Stroke of Insight. And Dorothy, I think virtually everyone has these experiences. I mean, that's the whole point of the book and the movie, is that regardless of what the skeptical world says, these things happen, and most of us know that. So we're trying to create a space, a safe space. Because what happens in the media... Yeah, we want to make it normal. We want to make the paranormal normal. Because what happens in the media is when someone has some dramatic experience like this, they get thrown up on Larry King Live, and then the professional skeptic comes in, and they cancel each other out, and it's nothing. Yeah, it's like matter and antimatter. And that's the whole point, I think, of the media, is to neutralize this stuff. Where, you know, we want to say, no, it's actually real. And just because we don't understand what's going on doesn't mean we should dismiss it.
One week, I was, in my 20s, when the first Kennedy was assassinated. Can everyone hear me? Oh. I was in my 20s and working in a library when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. But for 1 week beforehand, I had this horrendous feeling, and maybe a lot of other people did too that are my age, that something horrible was going to happen, something relentless. And then, you know, the feeling went away after he was assassinated. But then in 2006, there was a tragedy in my own apartment building. An employee of the business underneath me was murdered. But the strange part of it is that for a whole month beforehand, I would be playing this piece of Chopin. And that's why I think that intuition can come in the form of music. And I could not stop playing the piece, and it was the saddest. Chopin can have very sad pieces. It's a nocturne. And I kept thinking, what is wrong with me? Why can't I stop playing this piece, you know? But after the murder of this unfortunate woman, the piece stopped.
Right. I think this was the power of the Doug Mensch story, is that we don't allow ourselves to have these experiences rationally, and so they come out in something like fantasy writing or in music in this case, or a dream. You know, I think they seep in through other channels. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. Yeah, they both survived, but it was pretty dark.
Jeff.
Yeah.
So okay, I've had experiences like that, and I mean, it doesn't help with the lottery. What am I supposed to do with it? Because, I mean, right. You know, 9/11, I never watched TV my whole life. I know less about the American culture than anybody in this room, probably, because I've never watched TV. I'm a reader, except for 2 years of my life, which was before 9/11. And 2 weeks before 9/11, I received a healing. I had been bleeding for 2 years after 12 years of infertility treatment and 15 years of infertility treatment. But anyway, what happened is on 9/11, I turned the TV on for the first time in just months. And then I saw a plane go into a World Tower, you know. And what happened is I was at a hospital for 3 shifts. No other chaplain showed up at that hospital because the one that was paid was in another state in the National Guard. And my nephew later gave me a medal because I was on duty. And he was at Fort Polk where the president was supposed to go. So, you know, that was my experience, and I made a big difference because there were people in that building who had relatives in the World Trade, and I had a friend in the Pentagon. So the long and the short of it is I made a difference, but it doesn't work for the lottery. What am I supposed to do?
Right. No, that's actually a really good point because it doesn't work for the lottery. In fact, it doesn't work in almost any practical situation for any practical reason. These things cannot be replicated. It looks like they can't be trained, although there's some debate about that. They inevitably happen in crisis situations, and they happen between people who are emotionally connected. And the most dramatic occurrences usually involve death or the threat of death. And this is why laboratory parapsychology is so weak. Because, you know, laboratory parapsychology works with things like getting sophomores in a laboratory, showing them abstract shapes on playing cards, and getting them to try to communicate those to one another. Well, there's nothing at stake. There's no emotional connection. There's no crisis. Nobody's dying. And so they get a correlation, but it's very, very weak. The strong dramatic stuff always involves crisis and trauma and death, frankly. And so you can't replicate that ethically. You can't study that scientifically. You can do other things that are more humble, but again, the evidence suggests strongly that these things are invoked for very specific reasons, and they have nothing to do with the lottery. So that's why it doesn't work.
That building that I was in was destroyed within a year because it had no sprinkler system. It had labor and delivery on the 11th floor and maternity on the 10th floor, and they had to destroy it. They couldn't insure it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Pauline.
No, I don't want to stand up. Yeah, when I was struggling to understand some telepathic experiences of my own, I came across a book by a neurologist. I've forgotten his name, but the name of the book was Beyond Telepathy.
Uh-huh.
And he had, I guess his theory, or maybe he had some scientific basis for it too, was that a person who is an effective sender has a very high level of adrenaline in their body. So that's why in a crisis situation the messages would go out. But that the person who was the receiver was more likely to be in a sleep state or a meditative
yeah.
state and have a lot of choline
That's right.
Going through their bodies. Now, I thought that if I wanted to not receive from the person that I was receiving, that maybe I should increase the amount of adrenaline somehow, but I never figured out how to do it. Although maybe I have, because the phenomena has not continued in the intensity that it did at the time. But I thought that was possibly useful somehow in how we think about this.
I think the chemical stuff is a bit deceptive, frankly. I think it has to do with the state of consciousness for sure. Dreams are the number one place where people have these experiences. And it seems to be that this is the natural altered state that we all go into, where our ego is suppressed or barely there, and so other parts of the world can seep in. That's why dreams are so powerful, or can be so powerful.
Well, I guess what he was saying was that when you're in that kind of relaxed state, whether it's sleep or meditation, that the biochemistry changes.
It does. I think
a more adrenaline state to a more of a choline state.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I would just say that choline and adrenaline don't help us explain telepathy, only indirectly, that something else is going on there other than chemicals going through our bodies. I'm very suspicious of any purely physical explanations of these things. I think they have to do with spirit, frankly. But the spirit has profound correlations on the body, so I'm not against adrenaline and choline. I just don't think they explain it. Yeah. Mary. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm Mary. It's you, is it?
I hate it when old people do this, but there is a tie between William James and the origins of this conference that we can follow through, and I'm not going to take time to talk about it, but ask.
I just wonder, you've written a whole book, and we saw four stories. I wonder what the content of the book actually is beyond the anecdotal.
Yeah, the content of the book actually has nothing to do with what you just saw in terms of the four stories are just teasers, and this is designed actually, frankly, for an investor. We're trying to get money to make this movie. So the actual film and the actual book features four authors. Frederick Myers, the man who helped found this in the 19th century. Charles Fort, an American writer who lived in New York and wrote four very strange and wonderful books. The first was called The Book of the Damned, which we can talk about. The third is Jacques Vallée, this man who started out as an astronomer and computer scientists, and then began to write about UFOs and rejected the sort of hardware approach to them. He thought that they had something to do with the occult and the paranormal. And the fourth author is this Frenchman named Bertrand Meust, who's written extensively about the history of animal magnetism, mesmerism, spiritualism, all of these things. Because those are very technical. I mean, it's pretty technical, and I wanted to stick with the stories. You guys can speak afterwards. She just said she didn't learn anything.
Could you speak to near-death experiences and that? I noticed you haven't, and I'm interested in that.
Yeah. Near-death experiences are very much part of the mix here because they're ultimately about trauma and about someone almost dying. And you often get these same anomalous experiences during near-death. Somebody knows what's going on in the operating room when their brain is completely flatlined, for example. And again, it's similar in that they're out of their body, or at least their experiences, they're out of their body. They're not their brain. They're not their body. They're floating in this spiritual dimension. And like Jill, then they come down. It's very painful to come back down into the body and to be this limited ego again. So I think they're completely related because they reveal or suggest strongly that we're not just in the body and that we're something else. There's a lot of huge literature on near-death, as I'm sure you know.
Before I relinquish this mic, twins, from what I understand, have been known to experience one thing in one part of the world, and their twin experiences that same feeling in another part of the world.
Yeah, there's a large literature on twins, too. Yeah.
Just wanted to comment that after reading Jill Bolte Taylor, I went on to some other books. There's neurotheologians that say that the right hemisphere is proof of God.
Uh-huh.
And quite interesting.
Proof of God. Yeah.
I think. Do I have the mic over here? Is this my turn?
Oh,
yeah. Is it on? Yeah. All right. It seems to me that a gift that you have that you're bringing to bear in the space of this conference is your ability to put into language difficult states of being, to make a translation from those transmarginal fields that have been more or less cultured out or marginalized in the culture that we live in, this big field, that have always had importance and significance because they are archetypal fields that are not bound by time and space, that are that contain the information that governs, like the laws of God, the movement of life in and out of reality and then transmarginal fields and on beyond. So you have a gift for doing that, I think, and you've discovered a context, a university that will allow you to do that. So I think that one of the things that I'm really gaining from listening to you is I'm connecting with, I have thoughts and experiences within my own world, personally and transpersonally, that are real, that I have a few conversations with. And what I'm looking for and I'm finding in several different places, community of people who are seeking to find images and symbols that actually describe these archetypal fields and make it available to people in a bigger way inside the culture.
Right.
So I think thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Bonnie, that's really, I mean, that's what this book is about. And, you know, you have to understand, I don't live in the Quaker world, and I don't live in the Jungian world. I live in the academic world, and people like me get chewed up and spit out really quick. So I have to play that game, and I have to answer those criticisms, and I have to create this space that you're talking about. And so, you know, my work really is in that realm. But that's what I'm trying to do, is create a space in which serious people can have serious conversations about these things and not just be dismissed or demeaned or humiliated, which is actually what happens now.
And I'm on the verge of tears, which I am often anyway, because of that.
Okay.
And I find myself being moved deeply for the hunger for that.
Yeah. The story I always... I mean, Bonnie, I think that's it. I think that's what the project's about. I mean, the story I always tell here is I gave an early paper on this material at one of our national conventions, and it was to a group that are known to be the most hard-nosed, critical, materialist scholars. They mostly Marxists, actually. And I gave this paper on this material, and the respondent, who was a very large man, lots of testosterone and very well known, basically ripped my paper into little shreds. Not literally. No. And he did it in a weirdly affectionate fashion. But it was basically this. And then this amazing thing happened during the Q&A session. Went on for over an hour. Just person after person after person in the audience stood up, and they addressed Ivan. They did not address me. And they didn't argue with Ivan. They told stories. And it was just story after story for an hour. And finally, Ivan stands up and he says, okay. He says, look, I know this is real. I just don't know what to do with it. And then it gets better. He told a ghost story from his own family. It was about his mother-in-law dying, and when they were lowering her body into the grave, he heard her laughing in his brain very distinctly. And he says, I told my wife about this after the funeral, and she says, that's weird. I heard the same thing. And so this is how it ended. I was stunned. I was completely stunned. And so I think that's the secret. You see, the secret is that what this is really about is story and human beings and death and love. And, you know, to try to put it in a laboratory is completely to erase it. So.
I don't know where to begin exactly. But in your research, have you found that there are some people who are extremely susceptible or prone or afflicted or gifted with this and others who are not?
Absolutely.
Well, the reason I ask that is because I was pretty sure I was one of those people when I was younger and all through my life. And the last work I had before I went to college, I was working for some physicists who are a very open-minded place to work. But I worked in the lab, and there were several of us lab technicians. And it got to be kind of a game that they would ask me what people would be wearing when they came in. And I always knew. I always knew, even when they had something new they'd never worn before. And I finally got kind of embarrassed, but felt like I was dealing with something that was bigger than a joke and bigger than a party game, and I didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And then I went to college after that. First paper I wrote was on the research at the University of Duke, J.B. Pierce,
yeah,
you know, that research.
And you mean J.B. Ryan?
Yeah, Ryan, right. And came to the same conclusions that we've come to, that it can't be studied in the lab, but it does exist. And I wrote the paper, and then I kind of really did let go of it and tried not to let it happen until I went on with my left-brain career, and I finished with that now. And it's just coming back in spades. It's uncanny and weird and strange and just every day. Yesterday, my sister's back in California, and many of you know I've talked about her. I live with her. We love each other very much and get along very well. And so this week was the jazz festival in Sacramento, which I love. And she is going to it, and occasionally we call back and forth. I've only been able to reach her once since I'm here. She was at the jazz festival at my very, very favorite performance. She laughed and held up the phone so I could hear Tom Rigney play the violin. It was, you know, it's that uncanny and that real. And I'm still at this place where I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
I have no
idea.
Well,
none of us do. I think the point is just to accept it.
to accept it. Yeah.
Okay, I think we have to stop. Thank you very much.
Jeff, it doesn't always happen that so many people are still in the auditorium. Hold on, I have to wait till Dixon stops here. Give us a minute. Jeff, I just wanted to say it's not often that we have this much of a crowd still sitting in the audience on a Monday morning. So thank you so much for being with us, for sharing so much, and we look forward to hearing lots more good things about you.
Thank you. And I obviously won't be able to say goodbye to everybody, so let me do it right now. Thank you.